Hello and welcome to Atlantikbrücke's Transatlantic Call. My name is Robin Fehrenbach. I am Atlantikbrücke's Head of Research, and on behalf of Atlantikbrücke, I would like to welcome all of you to the 9th edition of this audio format. Today, our Transatlantic Call is entitled The Wall, U.S. Migration Policy in the Discussion. And it's my great pleasure to introduce our special guest in today's call, Mr. Blas Nunez Neto. He is Senior Policy Researcher at the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C. Blas is an expert with regard to questions of border security and U.S. migration policy. Prior to joining RAND, he served as a senior advisor to the Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, CBP. And previously, he had analyzed these issues for 11 years in the Senate Committee on Homeland Security. Blas, welcome, and thank you very much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Let's start our conversation right away, since there are so many hot aspects in this huge issue surrounding what we call the wall, especially our folks and members and young leaders in Europe are very interested. So to start right away, the U.S.-Mexican border is roughly 2,000 miles long. Can you give us an update? What distance has been newly covered with steel fences, walls, or let's say border installations since President Donald Trump took office?
So as far as I can, I'm aware, they actually have not constructed any real kind of significant new stretches of fencing. There are some kind of demonstration projects that they've constructed on the border to test different kinds of the technology. But, you know, as of, I think, you know, at least a couple months ago, they hadn't really been able to erect any substantial stretches of new construction on the border.
Okay. So
and some of this relates to some disputes and some funding issues, obviously, between the Congress and the administration and then even within the administration.
Right. So you would say right now the president is more creating some kind of showcase around the wall. We read that in near San Diego there is this site where a lot of prototypes are being shown. So it's more like an imagination of something happening and not really materializing yet.
So yeah, and you know, in San Diego, and I think in a couple other parts of the border, they've constructed some, you know, some demonstration projects to test different designs,
mm-hmm.
and that's important because the border is 2,000 miles long, and it's not all the same. You know, there are parts where that flood regularly. There are parts that are very mountainous and rugged, and so you know, it's not one design isn't going to work everywhere.
That makes sense a lot. Can you estimate how much of the distance maybe will be built when the next election is around the corner? So will there be something built up?
You know, so that is obviously a pressing question for the administration. I think what I've read and heard at least is that the president would like to construct up to 500 miles of you know, wall or fencing before the election, and there has been a little bit of a dispute, I think, internally around that's just come out in the news media the last couple of days around what the cost of that might be.
Right.
With the cost being, you know, the Department of Defense apparently concluding that the cost was substantially higher than what they had thought. And so, you know, they have, at least to date, moved very slowly in transferring the funds that the president would like transferred for construction.
Right. So 500 miles would be very ambitious. And still, although it's just a showcase, it's a serious topic, definitely. Can you explain us how did President Trump succeed now that he's being in office for 2.5 years in materializing a partial financing of his plans to build a wall on the southern border to Mexico, although you just tipped on that. The positions in Congress, of course, between Republicans and Democrats are totally divided.
Yeah, so the administration was unable to get Congress to approve funding for new barriers on the border, and it's probably worth pointing out that we already have, you know, roughly 700 miles of physical barriers, which include both pedestrian fencing, that is fencing that's intended to keep people from crossing, mm-hmm. and what they call vehicle barriers, which are, you know, just as they sound, intended to stop vehicles from crossing illegally. So we already have a fair amount of fencing, and I think there was a dispute between the administration and Congress over how much additional barriers were needed and how much those were going to cost. And so Congress, you know, declined to appropriate funding for that purpose. And in response, the president declared a national emergency on the border.
Yeah.
And under U.S. law, you know, in times of national emergencies, the administration, the president, has a fairly broad latitude to, you know, take emergency actions to include moving funds from accounts to pay for things that, you know, that address the emergency. So there's been some, you know, lawsuits surrounding this, and so
right.
far they have not succeeded in stopping the transfer of funding.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, despite that, it appears that the process is moving, you know, pretty slowly and probably more slowly than the administration would like.
Yeah, that's very interesting to hear that insight. The president's plans have also resulted in the longest shutdown in U.S. history with a duration of 35 days. Regarding the understanding of such measures in the public, how much is this kind of extreme policy accepted by American citizens?
Well, I think that the public has unfortunately grown a little bit used to government shutdowns. You know, they used to be extremely rare, and I think over the last, 7-8 years have become, you know, fairly regular. And I think it just,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's a symptom, I think, of a broader issue with our politics in the U.S. today, which, you know, is characterized by just a lot of polarization and, I think, an unfortunate short-sightedness when it comes to things like shutting the government down in order to achieve, you know, pretty tactical results by wielding what is a very blunt object.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think when it comes to shutdowns, the public, they're always tricky because, you know, even this last shutdown, you know, the entire government didn't shut down, just, you know, substantial parts of it. And I think what really... you know, when the public really gets upset is when they start to feel those effects. And this last time that occurred with air traffic controllers, you know, who after 35 days started being unable to keep the, you know, their current, the kind of operational tempo that they normally have. And that led to some airports having substantial delays. And that was, I think, what broke the camel's back when it came to the shutdown.
Mm-hmm. You already mentioned the national state of emergency, which Donald Trump also imposed, because he's always regularly speaking of a national crisis on the southern border. From your point of view, how severe is the problem of drug trafficking on the one side and crimes committed by illegal immigrants on the other side? Do you have numbers or statistics with that?
So, you know, drug trafficking has obviously been a historical, you know, a large historical issue across the border. It's important to note that the majority of the drugs that, you know, that I would be most concerned about, and those are the harder drugs like cocaine, heroin,
right?
You know, some of these synthetic drugs like fentanyl, those are actually, you know, more than 90% of those drugs generally come through our ports of entry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because they're, you know, they're easy to conceal. You can smuggle them in small quantities and still make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these aren't drugs for the most part that are being smuggled, you know, across the physical land border.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that's been a huge issue historically, and obviously it's fueled, you know, what has been kind of an opiate epidemic in the U.S.
Right.
You know, that is a real... A real problem and a real policy challenge, but you know the policy solutions, in my view, should focus more on, you know, what we can do to better detect and interdict those things at our actual ports of entry. You know, as far as the violence committed by migrants, I mean, you know, I as far as I know, there's no evidence that immigrants in the U.S. legal or illegal commit crimes at a higher rate than the average U.S. citizen.
Yeah.
So I don't believe that that's a huge concern. I think there has been a dramatic surge in migration over the last year and a half from Central America to the U.S., and it's predominantly been fueled by families and children. And so there, I don't think there's any doubt that there is a crisis on the border, but I think it's more of a humanitarian crisis than any other kind of crisis.
So Donald Trump is really trying to build a narrative working with fear, correct?
I think the president has, taken some incidents committed by, some bad actors and, often portrayed them as, things that happen all the time or routinely. And I'm not convinced that's exactly the case. I think that our border security agencies are, have been stretched to their breaking point. I think the real issue here is that we have, frontline law enforcement officers, i.e. Border Patrol agents, trying to handle a humanitarian crisis, right? They have to, they're being overwhelmed with young children and families and the rest of our, the way the system works in the U.S., our frontline border agencies at, at Customs and Border Protection, and that's the Border Patrol between the ports of entry and the Office of Field Operations at the ports of entry. Those, their facilities are only intended to hold people for very, very short amount of time. I mean, we're talking 12 to 24 hours. And other parts of the government, other parts of the government are supposed to take them and, take those populations that need to be detained and put them in detention facilities that are, geared to holding people for extended periods of time. Because the rest of the system has been completely overwhelmed by the surge in migration, we're seeing, people kind of stack up at our border facilities for many days at a time. And that is unsanitary, unsafe, and really, I think, unfair to our frontline law enforcement on the border.
Yeah, Blas, let's switch the focus right on that humanitarian crisis. Because that's a huge part of the whole issue. Will the deals with Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras that have been negotiated under high pressure by the U.S. government in 2019 really limit the illegal immigration into the USA on a permanent basis? What do you think?
They might. I think that you're already seeing the numbers decrease a little bit over the last couple months, and some of that could be seasonal. This is traditionally the time of year when migration starts to slow down a little bit. But it could also be, some of these policies taking effect. I think there's a bigger question about whether these policies will stand up in court. And you've already seen some kind of competing judgments by different courts around that question. There are in the Immigration and Nationality Act, the law that governs kind of migration to the U.S. There are provisions that would allow asylum seekers to remain in a third country, and it's known as the safe third country provision. I think people in Europe might be pretty familiar with that these days.
Absolutely.
And so in some respects, what the administration has done has been to implement something that looks a lot like a safe third country process without going through the actual kind of hoops that you need to go through to designate a country like Mexico a safe third country. And so I think that, that will probably be litigated over the next year.
Yeah, definitely.
But, whether they will take effect, I mean, I think they probably will. If they're allowed to stand, I would not be surprised if they actually do slow the flow a little bit in that, most of the people who are coming to the U.S. to seek asylum, they don't want to stay in Mexico, and they certainly don't want to stay in Guatemala.
Absolutely.
I think to...
You already talked about a lot of children that arrive with their families and parents at the American border. Why are children still being separated from their parents on American soil?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm not sure I have an answer for that. I mean, there is a, you know, there are, I think, legitimate reasons where children can sometimes be separated from their parents if their parents, you know, have committed a crime and
right.
if the government believes that the children will be endangered if they're remaining with their parents. So, you know, even in the Obama administration when I was at CBP, we would have some incidents where children were, you know, removed from their parents when it was deemed that their parents were, you know, were criminals. So, you know, that may be what's happening. Obviously, the family separation policy that was put in place last year was substantially broader than that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was just a kind of a routine policy. So it's unclear to me, based on the reporting I've seen, you know, why this is still happening and whether it's, you know, whether it's based on the parents being deemed to be dangerous for the children or whether it's just, you know, elements of the government still kind of continuing this family separation policy.
Okay, so there is no real long-term solution to that problem in place right now.
So, you know, I think I'm glad you said long-term solution because I think everyone's really been, I've been frustrated for years that the debate has been really focused on what's happening at the border,
mm-hmm.
which is really, you know, a symptom of the problem and not the actual problem.
Right.
You know, I think the actual problem is that our immigration system and our laws in the U.S. are, you know, antiquated, haven't been updated in almost 40 years,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, we need to reform our system. And we also need to recognize that, you know, these countries in Central America are, you know, essentially functioning almost like failed states where you have, you know, lawlessness and, you know, criminal elements, including,
mm-hmm.
you know, gangs like MS-13, you know, taking over wide swaths of the country and making life, you know, basically unlivable for large parts of the population.
Yeah. That's,
you know, and as a, sorry.
Yeah.
And I was to say, you know, as an American, I think we need to take some responsibility for that in that, you know, these gangs actually originated in the U.S. and were exported to Central America in the 1980s. So
that's an interesting
you know,
point. Yeah. That's a really good point. And let's take a look at the broader and bigger picture maybe at this point since you mentioned it. You have extensively analyzed U.S. migration policy and worked on legislation in the Senate. What policy would you recommend, maybe also in an ideal world or in a better world than it is right now, to, on the one hand, guarantee an effective immigration system with secure borders, while simultaneously, on the other side, allowing for human procedures in the face of seeking asylum?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I don't think it's, frankly, rocket science. I mean, I think, you know, when I was working in Congress, you know, there were multiple efforts under President George Bush, a Republican, and
mm-hmm.
Barack Obama, a Democrat, to pass comprehensive immigration reform. And I think what's interesting about those efforts, which again were, you know, one led by a Republican president, one led by a Democratic president, was that the broad contours of the reform were fairly, you know, fairly similar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they almost it generally involve accepting that, you know, we have somewhere between 10 and 13 million people living without legal status in the U.S. And
right.
You know, we'll never be able to find and remove them all.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, these people have been here for decades and, you know, have built lives in the U.S. and have U.S. citizen offspring.
Yeah.
And, you know, we need to provide those people with some avenue for, you know, having some kind of legal status, whether that's citizenship or, you know, something on the continuum towards citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it involves obviously making smart investments in our border that are actually, you know, targeting the problems we see on the border are not, just building things, you know, to make us feel better.
Yeah.
And I think it also involves, you know, acknowledging, I think, that, we need guest workers, we need migration, as you do in Europe, right? We have a population that's aging and
right.
that requires, you know, and has become accustomed to benefits like Social Security and Medicare. And I think without having a robust kind of migration, it's going to be very difficult to continue that in the future. So some level of immigration is almost, is required, basically.
Yeah, that's a really great answer. And another question would be, is it sometimes very dangerous for immigrants to be sent back to the Mexican side of the border because they are exposed to robbery or violence? Could you elaborate on that? What do you know about that?
Sure. So, I mean, I think one of the things that doesn't get talked about enough with these, you know, families and children
mm-hmm.
making the trip from Central America to the U.S. is that, you know, that journey is incredibly dangerous and involves putting themselves, you know, in the hands of, you know, smugglers and criminals and just, basically putting their lives into their own hands, right? And there are horrible stories about,
mm-hmm.
you know, the percent of the women who make this kind of journey that end up, being violated in some way or other.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's a deep concern, and it's probably one of the reasons why, you know, Mexico would be difficult to actually designate Mexico a safe third country. I mean, Mexico has taken enormous strides over the last 20 to 30 years,
mm-hmm.
And has become a middle-income country and, has improved its security situation, you know, notwithstanding the wars with the cartels.
Right.
But, you know, it is still a pretty dangerous place, and, you know, migrants get routinely taken advantage of and have crimes committed against them. So, I think that's a legitimate concern.
The United States is gearing up to the 2020 presidential election already, of course, because it's such a huge process. What do you think? How important will this whole issue with the wall really be in that presidential election?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's interesting that, unfortunately, one of the features of this day and age is that the elections in the U.S. never actually seem to stop.
That's true. But to some degree, that's also true for Europe, I can tell you.
Is that right? I'm always a little envious of the parliamentary system where your elections are measured in weeks and not years. I think it's clear to me, at least, that the administration wants to make it a very, primary issue during the election.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you hear from Democrats is probably more of a focus on economic and, like, healthcare issues, you know, than
right.
migration. So it will be, I think that will probably be some sign of where the election is headed, about, you know, depending on what you hear more of in the debates, I guess.
Right, and you mentioned the Democratic Party, of course. Even if they make a real focus on the economy and on the healthcare system, which is very important, of course, what is the Democrat strategy to counter the narrative of the president on this issue, on migration? Do they have a sophisticated plan that really offers an alternative to what the GOP has to offer?
Yeah, you know, I think unfortunately the Democrats are fairly divided on
mm-hmm.
the issue, you know, and you have a wide range, you know, of you've got people on the far left who, you know, want to basically abolish, you know, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is in charge of Interior Immigration Enforcement in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
and that's a view that I personally, and this is not, Rand talking, think is
right.
short-sighted. I think that there are things that Democrats ought to be speaking about on this topic, and one of them is that, you know, this administration has, you know, has used a lot of tough rhetoric on migration, but has overseen the most rapid increase in illegal immigration in quite some time. I think,
yeah,
you know, we were on track for a million apprehensions at the border this fiscal year, and that would be the largest number since the early 2000s,
mm-hmm.
and almost three times what we saw during the last couple of years of Obama's administration. So, I think those are the kinds of discussions that Democrats should be having.
Mm-hmm. So,
but again, that's my personal opinion.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So maybe kind of focus more on facts and pragmatic policy solution that really work and really work on a long-term reform.
I think that's fair, and I think also, mm-hmm. you know, the president, again, has really been relentlessly focused on building the wall.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when you talk to people on the border itself and the border communities, most mm-hmm. of the people you meet down there, they actually don't want that kind of a physical, you know, imposing kind of barrier on the border. Those border communities have, you know, long histories of people going back and forth and ties on both sides of the border.
Yeah.
You know, and I think kind of giving those people more of a voice in this debate is important.
That's also a great aspect, definitely. Maybe they are not heard enough or not involved enough, but that's a really good point. Blas, let's come to our last question for our transatlantic call. The USA has always been a country of immigration. I think that's fair enough to state this. Will it lose its status of an almost mythical land where you can fulfill your personal dreams if you just try hard enough?
Oh, I truly hope not, and I don't think so. I mean,
okay.
I myself am an immigrant. You know, I'm a naturalized citizen. I'm originally from Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, yet, you know, having not been born in the U.S., I've had the privilege to, you know, work as a senior advisor to multiple, you know, senators on an important
right.
committee in the Senate. I've, you know, been a presidential appointee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think those are the kinds of opportunities that still exist in the U.S. for immigrants, and I think will exist, you know, for as long as the U.S. is a country. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, you mentioned the U.S. is an immigrant country, and that's true, but immigration has always been a polarizing debate in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
getting back, you know, hundreds of years. So I think those two things can both be true. You know, we can continue to struggle politically with what, you know, what the right amount of immigration is, while nevertheless still being an immigrant country where immigrants can really make a difference.
Great. I would say let's stop with this kind of optimistic and hopeful note at the end. Thank you very much, dear Blas, for having shared your insights and expertise related to this highly relevant topic. We really appreciate this. And,
thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation, and thanks for inviting me.
Sure, perfect. Thank you so much. And I would also like to thank the audience for joining this transatlantic call. And with that, have a good day in the United States and a nice evening in Europe. Thank you and goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.